yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. All right, the topic of the week of interest is Davos. You know, that retreat up there in the mountains of Switzerland where the elite go, the World Economic Forum. They trip up there every year, and super security. You know, if you don't have passes, you can't get through all the checkpoints. You know, guys sitting around behind trees with their machine guns just in case all the uppities charge up the hill. Well, they gather every year and they celebrate amongst themselves. And they communicate and coordinate and share strategies and policy. This is the global capitalist class. They meet, and of course they have fun. You know, it's a big retreat, and they invite entertainers to come. You know, people who have become multimillionaires, has-beens, you know, come up there and they entertain, and sometimes they even get you know, the rock groups of their youth, you know, the Stones or whatever, and Sting and all those folks go up there, and they, you know, it's kind of like Las Vegas for the rich without the gambling, because they do their gambling in a fixed returns. You know, they don't go to places. These people don't go to Las Vegas's and so forth. You know, their gambling is guaranteed returns. No chance. No chance. Okay, so Davos. This year, they're celebrating. What are they celebrating? Well, they're celebrating the short-term return of synchronized global economic growth. Synchronized. In other words, all the major areas of the global economy seem to have recovered a little bit in terms of growth. China, of course, has led the charge here and sort of primed the pump in 2016-17 to get the global economy going in anticipation of President Xi and the Communist Party that had its meeting last year, you know, wanted real growth going. So he could get his programs through, which he did, of course, and a lot more authority for himself. Well, you know, it took exceptional return to growth in China, because in 2015, the stock market crashed big time. And ever since in China. And ever since then, well, it's recovered. Ever since then, you know, Chinese debt has escalated. And total debt now, private debt, household debt, government debt, is like 250% of GDP. GDP about $10 trillion, $11 trillion. Second largest economy in the world behind the U.S. So, you know, they flooded the economy with free money in China. And, of course, that free money, a good part of it, maybe most of it, did not go into real growth. Some of it did. But a lot of it went into financial asset speculation, other markets. You know, the money flowed out of the stock market, and some of it started flowing abroad, but the Chinese kind of plugged that hole. And then, of course, the money speculative money in China as a result of Chinese central bank and foreign liquidity injections on a massive scale stimulated other financial asset markets like entrusted loans, trust loans, asset wealth management products, and properties in some some cities. So the money just keeps moving around, you see. And now China, beginning of the year, signaled after the end of the Chinese Communist Party conference, signaled, though, well, now we're going to turn our guns here, the government guns, on these speculators once again, even if we got to accept slower growth. So the future in China is going to be short term, is going to be slower growth, and its stimulative effect on the global economy is going to be reduced. Ah, but we're still enjoying, the global economy is still enjoying the aftermath of that stimulative effect. Well, that's not the only factor. It's a major factor responsible for the global synchronized growth going on. Not the only one. The other factor is Donald Trump and signaling big windfalls coming for corporations, big windfalls. And of course, the windfalls came in 2017. What were they? Big cost cutting by deregulation and by the massive tax cut for business. We'll talk about this tax cut a little bit more. We've been addressing it. I've been doing more research on it and the true impact and the true scope and magnitude of the business investor tax cuts here under Trump just passed. And I'll be writing on that as well. So take a look at my blog next week, jackrasmus.com, or some of the other blogs that I write for, Counterpunch, CNET, Telesur, Global Research, and of course, magazines. And those are posted on my website, which is kyklosproductions.com, KYKLOS productions.com. My longer pieces, book reviews, and everything are there. All right. So we have the release of the animal spirits that have boosted some of the investment in the U.S. in 2017. GDP figures here that just came out, U.S. fourth quarter GDP preliminary figures come out today, show that it's already slowing down. The animal spirits may be, at least as far as real investment is concerned, not maybe financial investment, investing in stocks, bonds, derivatives, and stuff. But real investment, in other words, in business and structures, residential and commercial structures, plants, and office buildings and stuff like that, is already slowing down significantly. And the big inventory buildup that occurred in 2017, as the animal spirits expected more consumption, which they got to some extent in the U.S. because of the hurricanes, really boosted auto production. Autos would really be in free fall, and they will be in 2018. And of course, the rising interest rates are beginning to choke off residential construction, and we now have a flat, pretty much, commercial property. So, construction, buildings and structures, part of real investment, is flattening and declining. And inventories all got overbuilt and they are declining or slowing in terms of growth. I don't mean negative. All of this is slowing growth rates, which has an effect on GDP, of course. And then what's also happening is the U.S. trade deficit is beginning to widen once more. And of course, that took a big whack out of fourth quarter GDP because imports are subtracted from exports. And if you have a negative net exports, in other words, imports greater than exports, that's called negative net exports. And if that happens, that subtracts from GDP. Well, that's going to get worse. Government spending, well, the federal government is really boosting its defense spending. That's growing nicely. But the other state and local forms of spending elsewhere are not doing so good. Well, they hope they're going to get infrastructure spending, but I don't believe it will happen. It will be a smoke and mirrors infrastructure, this public partnership, private partnership BS, which isn't going to boost infrastructure much. It'll be a smoke and mirrors phony infrastructure bill. You know, we got these animal spirits released by Trump and $5 trillion coming, $4 trillion business. And I'll, as I said, I will explain that in a little more detail shortly. But those animal spirits in the U.S. Were released here last year, and we got some investment going. Since 2008, investment rate has been declining. Well, it actually went negative for a while. And then, of course, the growth rate itself after 2010 in real investment in the U.S. and globally, except in China, it has been slowing. Its growth rate has been slowing compared to the decade prior to 2008-09 crash. Okay, so we have a long-term slowdown in real investment going on. A little aberration to that this past year for reasons I just described, animal spirits and hurricanes and replacement in the U.S. You know, hundreds of thousands of cars were replaced in the U.S. as a result, buildings and services and so forth. Okay, so that's responsible, along with China, for the economic growth blip returning globally. And that's the positive thing. And the folks in Davos are partying around, oh, how great we're doing, you know. Well, that's the surface. That's the short term and the surface. Below the surface is some very, very, really dangerous forces emerging for the global economy, and they shouldn't be partnering so much because it's not so great. Well, what are those? Well, I talked about the investment, global investment net slowdown long term, which, by the way, is largely responsible for the productivity slowdown. And the productivity slowdown has an impact on dampening wage growth and compressing wages and wage income. So, you know, those three are related. Real asset investment requires real jobs and therefore real income, wage growth. And if you don't have real asset investment growing robustly, then productivity is a problem. And then businesses with a low productivity don't tend to give wage increases, you know, because low productivity means rising unit labor costs, not because of wages, but because of productivity slowing or declining. Well, you know, if their labor costs are rising, they're not going to give wage increases on top of labor costs rising because of low productivity. So those three are all linked, and it's a long-term secular trend going on of slowing real investment, real productivity, real wage incomes. I talk about that in great detail, by the way, in my 2016 book, Chapter 13, on labor market restructuring as well as financial restructuring. That's been going on in the 21st century that is largely responsible for the excess speculation in financial asset markets and slowing in real investment markets. That shift going on. And corresponding with that, we have a big change going on in the labor markets that is slowing wage growth in the labor market. So the financial restructuring and changes are driving capital gains incomes and the slowing changes in labor markets and slowing of wage incomes are compressing wage or earned incomes, as they call them. Well, if, you know, capital incomes are accelerating in their rate of growth, which they are, and wage incomes, earned incomes, are stagnant, compressed, well, you get this incredible income inequality gap that's growing everywhere. And that's the large explanation for this, you know. Mainstream economics, you know, they look at the wage side, earned incomes, because that's the way they're trained. And they say, yeah, there's wage stagnation and so forth. That must have something to do with the income inequality. And of course it does. And so they say, well, let's raise the minimum wage, you know, in the U.S. You already got 20 million people, a minimum and near minimum wage. Out of 165 million labor force, so let's you know, stretch out over 5 years, you know, a quarter or 50 cents a year increase in the minimum wage as a solution to the income inequality. Well, that's a joke, you know. The real problem of inequality is runaway capital gains incomes, you know, incomes from stocks and bonds and derivatives and currency speculation and property and all that. That's the real source of income inequality. But mainstream economists don't talk about that because they don't understand the financial side and financial cycles, you see. They're all trained in, quote, real data, not financial data, in national income product accounts, and their models, the DSG models and everything, are all based on, quote, real data, you know. And they don't understand financial cycles at all and how they affect real cycles. Well, that's covered in my Systemic Fragility book of 2016. Reviews on the website and on the blog. And of course, my subsequent book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, steps back even further and says, well, why do we have all this accelerating financial speculation going on? Well, it's because the central banks have been pumping in free money for decades, and especially since 2008 and 9. $25 trillion, far more than is needed to expand, or that they want to use to expand real investment. So where does it go? Well, it goes into their creating new liquid financial asset markets and new kinds of financial securities to invest in and make money from money instead of making money from things, you see. Make money from money, you don't have to hire anybody. Make money from things, you got to hire people. I'm not saying that there's no money from things being made, yes, but in a relative sense, you know, the shift is the financial asset investing. And who's making it all possible? Well, the central banks, just putting in all this money. The central banks used to have the function of controlling the money supply and lender of last resort when banks got in trouble. Well, now they got a new function after 2008, and that's to permanently subsidize the banks and the financial shadow banks and so forth, permanently with free money. Well, you know, they're trying to get their hands back around some control of the money supply, trying to raise rates a little bit. But as I've said, they can't raise them much further, you know, maybe a half or 1% at the most, without provoking another credit crisis and credit crunch. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. But they've done their job. They've subsidized, you know, investors and bankers and so forth, and very nicely in the last decade since 2008. And, you know, they've reached the limit. They realize they're causing ultimately a lot of these financial bubbles. They realize that, and they're trying to back off on that. And in that vacuum, now you've got not the central bank, but the governments like Trump, who are delivering another massive subsidization of capital and business incomes with their massive tax cuts and deregulation. Oh, what? It's estimated that Fortune 500 companies will get a profits windfall between 10 and 31% because of the Trump tax bill. 10 to 31%, you know, fatten your take-home income by that much. Wouldn't it be nice to get that much of a raise? Okay, so they're giving themselves a raise through their government politicians, you know. And that's you know, one of the characteristics of the Trump period here. A shift to tax policy as a way to subsidize capital incomes, where the central bank, the Fed, used to do it and has to back off. Well, now into that void steps the government and takes over with fiscal policy. Right? It used to be that monetary and fiscal policy was designed to stabilize the economy. Well, it's not used for that anymore. It's designed to subsidize capital incomes, businesses and corporations and investors. That's its function today. That's changed, you know. And that reflects a growing competition among capitalists globally, you see. And we'll talk about that a little bit more, because that's we see some signals, other signals of that beginning to occur here as well in 2018. And in fact, just this past week, well, I'll talk about that, has to do with Treasury Secretary Mnuchin signaling that we're going to keep, the U.S. is going to keep the dollar low, and caused a lot of heartburn with other capitalist countries that rely on a currency that is not rising in relationship to the U.S. dollar, like in Europe, the euro, and Japanese, the yen. Okay, we can get ahead of ourselves. We'll talk about that. Let's go back to the negatives at Davos for the global elite. And the positive is has been this growth in synchronized global economic recovery here. And not a great recovery, don't get me wrong. It's not as robust as it was before 2008, but, you know, it was pretty... pretty much on the downturn for years here. The global economy has been slowing in terms of growth rate. And if it weren't for China, it would really be slow. And it's not all that great a recovery, but there is, for reasons I just stated. Now, what are the negatives that the folks at Davos are facing? And of course, Trump went to Davos, the World Economic Forum, and gave a speech here this morning. We'll talk a little bit about that. Why did he go is the question. And why did they do what they did, the U.S. Trump team, right before he went? And what was that? Well, Mnuchin signaled, we're going to lower the dollar. We like a low dollar. And then they also signaled, well, we're putting tariffs on Chinese goods and on Korean goods. And we're taking a hard line in NAFTA renegotiations with Mexico and Canada. In other words, shots across the bow by the U.S. elite as Trump trundles off to Davos, right? Gives a speech. It's a warning. It's a warning that American capitalists under Trump are saying we're about to renegotiate the rules of the game even more in our favor, folks. We don't like the fact that you know, we're not getting as much as we used to in terms of the global economic capitalist pie. We want a bigger piece. And that's what Trump is all about, you see. He's not against free trade. He wants to renegotiate all the trade deals and give a better deal for the U.S. corporate elite. That's what it's all about. That's what NAFTA's about. That's what's going on with China and Europe and so forth. So it's a shot across the bow as he goes to Switzerland and gives his little speech, America first. Well, what did he say? He said, America first, but you guys can come along. You come along with us, behind us, and in our wake. And, you know, you get to play the game. We're not going to shut you out totally, but, you know, we're going to cut out a little bigger piece of the pie for ourselves, the U.S., Trump, and so forth. That's what he's saying. It's the more aggressive wing of U.S. capital in the driver's seat. Now, it's not just Trump. Don't think that this whole thing about America first and economic nationalism is really about doing something for workers in this country, because it's not going to do that. It's going to have just the opposite effect. Well, let's just look at the Trump tax cuts, right? Let's look at multinational companies, U.S. multinational companies, offshore. They have the provision in the bill to reduce the taxes for offshore U.S. company, multinational offshore profitability, right, to 8% from 35. Well, they weren't paying the 35, you see, but 8%, 8% for cash held offshore, you know, a little bit more for other kinds of, well, no, it's 8% for non-cash liquid securities and 15 for cash. Okay, well, let's just say, you know, multinational companies aren't stupid. They're going to convert to non-cash, whatever cash holdings they have offshore. So they only have to pay the 8% instead of the 15 under the new law. But that's a hell of a lot less than 35%, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So, you know, it's going to be a big windfall for those folks. And I'll talk about that. I'm getting ahead of myself again here. We'll talk about how much of a windfall under the Trump tax are multinationals going to get, particularly those that have a big offshore presence, you know, like the tech companies, the pharmaceutical companies, the banks, oil and energy, all those. They're big players offshore, and they've been avoiding taxes for quite some time. And by the way, those tax loopholes are not closed under the Trump tax bill. They're still there. All right, so back to the negatives that the folks at Davos face, the global capitalist elite, right, who are now, you know, beginning to fight amongst themselves a little bit here. Yeah, intensifying intra-capitalist competition is a hallmark of the Trump era, as Trump attempts to strong-arm his capitalist cousins offshore into a better deal for his U.S. friends. All right. Now, what's the negative that the folks at Davos should be concerned about? And that is global trade. Even though it's recovered a little bit, global trade is on a long-run slowdown. Well, that makes it even more important that the Europeans and the Japanese somehow find a way to protect the advantages they've been able to obtain here as part of this whole global arrangement, globalization arrangement, you see. You know, if there's a net slowdown, the global pie, the trade pie, is not growing like it used to. And therefore, you know, the different capitalist sectors begin fighting over who gets a bigger cut of a pie that is not growing very much. All right. Global trade as a percent historically for decades until 2008 was growing faster than global GDP. You know, from 1985, really begins from to accelerate. Global trade begins to accelerate around mid-1980s. Well, this is part of neoliberalism, U.S. neoliberal policies, of course. So, between 1985 and 2006, global trade grew at about a 7% annual rate versus a 3.5% growth for global GDP. So global trade was growing twice as fast as GDP. And of course, that benefited Europe and Japan and all the other emerging markets. And they liked that, right? 7% versus 3.5%, right? By 2006-07, it was the comparison was 9% growth in global trade, really booming, versus a 5% growth in global GDP, doing very well, right? Right before the crisis, 9% versus 5%. Global trade growing still twice as fast, approximately, than global GDP. Of course, all that collapsed in 2008-09. For a while, GDP collapsed globally. Well, came close to collapsing. China kept it up, right? And global trade declined. Its growth rate slowed to about 3%. So from 9% to 3%. That's because emerging markets, China and others, benefited from the 2008-09 crash. I don't want to go into that. You can read about that in my books. both central bankers to the end of the rope and systemic fragility. Okay, so between 2010 and 12, right, trade was actually growing slower than GDP, growing slower. The U.S. didn't recover very well. It's kind of flat and stagnant, and of course Europe fell into another recession, so did Japan. So GDP slowed, but trade slowed even more. There was a little recovery in 13-14, where trade started growing again at 6% versus 4% global GDP. And in 2015 and 17, it began to look like it was going to continue, but now global trade has slowed once again after 2015. In relation to GDP, they're about growing at the same rate, you see. And the trade may slip below GDP after this year. Okay, so overall, if you look at the whole period from 85 to the present, the picture is one of more weakness in the growth rates of global trade. And even when GDP slows, trade slows even more, which is especially since 2008 in stark contrast to trade exceeding, doubling, trade rate of growth, doubling the growth of GDP, even when GDP was robust. Well, it's just the opposite. Trade either growing slower than GDP or about GDP rates since 2008. That should be something of a worry for the folks at Davos. By the way, this is all IMF data, that's the long-term trend. And you see, that's why we get this intra-capitalist competition intensifying, because if the pie is not growing as fast, trade, then fights break out over who's going to get a piece of the pie at the expense of somebody else. Intercapitalist competition. You start getting trade wars, and of course protectionism is a signal of pending trade wars. The U.S. is attacking the World Trade Organization as ineffective. Well, in other words, ineffective for us, when we used to get the rates of return globally aren't so great anymore because the other capitalists are getting a piece of the pie, so we got to reverse that and go back to the 1960s and 70s. Well, that's what this is all about, trade wars. Closely associated with trade wars are currency wars, because if you can reduce the value of your currency in relation to other currencies, it gives you a big cost advantage in trade and the cost of your goods. So currency wars and trade wars, tariffs and so forth, are closely associated with each other. And we see both about to break out here. And this is part of the signal that Trump has sent and Mnuchin has sent right on the eve of his Davos visit. Big news of the week is Mnuchin says that, we like the low dollar, the low dollar. Well, other competitors don't like the low dollar. The Europeans want the dollar to rise, because if the dollar rises, then their currency declines in relationship to the dollar, and it makes their products, exports, more competitive vis-a-vis the dollar. All this massive injection of liquidity by central banks, particularly in Europe and Japan, is designed to flood the markets with dollars, well, in the case of euros and yen, to lower their exchange rates. That reduces the value of their currency, which they want to do because then they can export more. Europe is far more dependent on exports than the U.S. is for its general economy. That's why Germany is doing so well. It's exporting quite effectively, and most of its exports are sold within Europe, and that's why Germany is getting rich at the expense of the periphery of the rest of Europe. Well, I covered that in my 2016 book, Looting Greece, A New Financial Imperialism Emerges. Well, that's really about how Germany and this euro system has been set up to benefit Germany and the banks in the northern European countries at the expense of the periphery. And that's exactly what's been done. Germany has done fairly well. The other countries have been slipping in and out of recession in Europe. Europe in general is more dependent on exports. And when Mnuchin says, "Oh, we want to keep the dollar low," that's our policy slip of the tongue, right? The European Central Bank chair there, Mario Draghi, got upset. He had a bad case of heartburn and pretty much immediately attacked Mnuchin and said, "Well, what are you doing, Steve? Come on. I thought we had an agreement that the dollar was going to rise faster than the euro, which would help Europe recover and therefore stimulate the European stock markets as well, as profits from exports increased, you know." And the process had just begun in Europe of recovery through exports. But now with this quote, competitive devaluation signal from Mnuchin, the Europeans say, "Well, you're going to stop our recovery in the tracks." And the same for the Japanese, right? That's why Europe and Japan is going to continue pumping liquidity into the economy to keep the currencies low, the exchange rates low, just in case, the U.S., which is unpredictable under Trump here, follows Mnuchin and keeps the dollar low. If they're all trying to keep the dollar and the yen and the euro low, that's competitive devaluations de facto, see? And that's a big problem for the Davos crew if this currency devaluations, competitive currency wars, let's call them, erupts once again. It erupted back a few years ago, and then they got under control, and now they're worried. Well, is this going to be another return to currency wars and competitive devaluations? They don't like that. Well, that's a worry. That's a worry. Along with global trade growing slower than global GDP now. Another big issue is global income inequality. Global income inequality, Oxfam came out with a report, this annual report, that showed that 82% of all the world's wealth is held by 1% of the population. The wealthiest 1%, right? And, the rest of us, 99%, get to divide amongst themselves the remaining 18. The Oxfam report showed that the bottom 50% of the world population got nothing from the economic growth of recent years. As of 2017, nothing. 42 billionaires got more wealth than 3.7 billion people. The bottom 50% got nothing, right? 42 billionaires' wealth holdings are equal to whatever the three half of humanity has. 42 people have more than half of humanity, right? Income inequality, wealth inequality, accelerating still more and more. Well, that's what's feeding the populism and the nationalism in large part, the destruction of decent paying jobs and replacing them with part-time temp gig jobs, what they call the precariat, used to call the working class the proletariat. Well, now we've got half of it being the precariat, precarious employment, part-time temp, and so forth. And the issue is so serious, you know, like in Europe in recent years, 60, 70, 80% of all the job creation has been part-time temp work. You got a workforce, a two-tier workforce, most of them in the precariat are young folks, millennials, who have no real permanent jobs and poor paying jobs, no pensions and so forth. And it's causing a lot of unrest in Europe. So the capitalists in Europe have figured out how to exploit this discontent of the precariat by saying, oh, we're going to pass labor market reforms, which will make it easier for corporations and businesses to hire full-time people again. You know, that's what they say. That's the excuse. And people fall for it, but it's not going to happen. There'll be fewer jobs in total. And there'll be more layoffs and more firings. That's what labor market reform in France is all about. Well, it's catch up to the U.S. model. Employ the U.S. model is what it's all about. Another report, the World Inequality Report, that is annually issued by Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty, based on a database they have at UC Berkeley. I mentioned Saez before. Check it out, World Inequality Report. 1% of the population in the U.S. have 27%, right, of all the income gains. 1% have 27% of all the income. Okay, well, how many is 1%? Right? We're talking about, you know, 600,000-700,000 people, the wealthiest 1% households in the U.S. By the way, that wealthiest 1% households are getting the lion's share of the Trump tax cuts. Okay, so global inequality, income and wealth inequality, is another thing the Davos men, as they call them, should be concerned about. Another concern is global debt. Global debt is at record levels again. Record levels. Why is debt important? Not because it's just debt in and of itself, but because debt is often used to finance investment and consumption during good times, especially if your incomes aren't growing, which is in the case of workers. Right? The middle class are all workers. If your income, your wage income, is not growing, right? How do you finance consumption? Well, you only have two other ways to do it. One is to pull your money out of savings, or don't put it in savings and use it to finance current consumption, or to borrow more money to finance current consumption. And you see, consumption spending in the U.S., in particular by U.S. households, has been held up up to now by debt and savings. The savings rate historically for U.S. households was around 10% of your total disposable income. But now it's less than 3%. It's down to 2.9%. Well, that's where it was in 2007. So people are not saving, they're spending. Their savings, they're drawing down their savings, they're spending what they should be saving, right? We have a super low, historic low savings rate. At the same time, we have a accelerating household debt ratio going on, right back to where it was. Over $12 trillion, maybe $13 trillion U.S. households are in debt, you know. Most of that is still mortgage debt, $7-8 trillion. But now over $1 trillion in student debt, over $1 trillion in auto debt, over $1 trillion in credit card debt. So we have all these sources of debt. And now we're going to have more medical debt going on with the destruction of ACA, Affordable Care Act. So U.S. households are right back where they were, very fragile. Because it is the relationship between your debt level and your income growth level, debt growth and levels and income level and rate of change, right? That's important for a crisis. It's the ratio. It's not just debt per se. It's your ability to service the debt, to pay the principal and interest on the debt. That's critical. Because the debt accumulated during the good times does not go away when the bad times come and prices collapse, whether financial or real prices decline in a crisis, right? People lose their jobs, so you lose your ability to pay the principal and interest on the debt, so you default, and when you default, whoever was holding or gave you that credit and that debt, right, they then have massive losses as well. They have to, accounting-wise, record losses. And then they act to offset their losses, usually by laying people off, which creates even more problems of the income ability to service the debt. And that goes on, by the way, for corporations and businesses and government as well, not just households. It's the same kind of scenario, same kind. Corporations have loaded up on debt as well, massively in the U.S. Why? Because the central bank has made interest rates so low for so long, it's cheaper for corporations to issue corporate bonds, which is debt, than it is to borrow money from a bank or to use their internal funds to pay their shareholders dividends or to buy back their stock. So what they do is they sell debt to investors, you know, investment grade bonds or junk bonds, right? And use that to pay their folks, their shareholders, you see. Okay, so corporate debt is at record levels, especially in emerging markets, you know, which are moving towards dollarized debt. In other words, issuing bonds in dollars. So when the crisis comes in the U.S., the contagion is going to be even stronger. The contagion will be even faster and deeper in the emerging markets. Okay, so government debt, of course, that's been running up too because of all the tax cuts and more spending. So we have the situation of these three sectors, right? The government debt, massive, and the ability to finance that debt with your tax cuts, you have less tax revenue, right? And you have to borrow more from people around the world in order to finance your debt, which isn't good. And then corporations massively indebted and households massively indebted again. And this is going on around the world. Big problem. Davos, you better watch that. Big problem. Global debt record levels, which, you know, they're being able to service it as long as there are jobs, as long as prices rise, as long as profits rise, and so forth. And you could argue that one of the reasons we have this big profits subsidization and windfall going on is to help corporations service that huge run-up in the debt that's been occurring long-term. Well, how bad is the corporate debt? Well, there's over $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans alone in the global economy, $10 trillion. In other words, no one's paying the interest and principal on the debt, $10 trillion of it. And they're sitting on this, and they can't get rid of it. Okay, so that's a big problem, global debt levels. Productivity and wage stagnation globally, I already talked about that. This relationship to earned incomes and so forth, right? Savings rates, et cetera. The slowdown in real asset investment, the animal spirits in the U.S. and related economies is already showing some signs of weakening. China is slowing down, and a rising dollar will affect Europe and Japan. Okay. And then the trade and currency wars that seem to be on the edge of erupting once again. Trump's America First, Mnuchin's slip of the tongue regarding low rates, Draghi getting pissed off, right, saying you are violating our understanding, right, and trade intensification, tariffs on South Korea and China, NAFTA, right? All of these things are real. So what we got is the U.S. elite going on the offensive and disrupting all of these forces and negative forces and developments in the global economy, right? And what it's causing is it's fueling this populism and nationalism going on. Populism, of course, as people below the elite level beginning to feel the crunch of some of these developments and beginning to get resentful that only the rich are getting subsidized through the central bank or from the tax policies and not them. And they'll find out the Trump tax cuts aren't going to deliver at all. Why? Well, for one reason, if you're cutting multinational corporations tax rates in half or less, right? 8% versus 35. Actually, they were paying an effective rate of about 17-18. Now they pay 8 nominal and probably 5 or 6 effective rate. Well, if they're paying so much less taxes offshore, why shouldn't they move jobs from the U.S. to offshore? It'd be more profitable for them to do so. Well, some people argue, well, tax savings are not the only factor for moving offshore. No, there's other ways of manipulating the tax code, in corporate inversions, right, where they simply move their headquarters to Bermuda or Cayman Islands or something like that, and they book their profits at the lower rate there, even though they make them in the U.S., because they just, accounting-wise, they can shuffle their profits around by intracompany pricing, which they do. By the way, Google books most of its intellectual property, its software development and so forth, profits, guess where? Cayman Islands. And then they move it to Ireland. They move the profits to Ireland, where they pay far less taxes, the money is transferred from Cayman Islands to Ireland, and they make a big killing on their tax cuts. And they don't pay Uncle Sam, right? That's just one company. Apple's the same way. How did Apple accumulate $270 billion offshore? Offshore, 270, 95% of the $270 billion cash short of Apple was offshore. How the hell did it get offshore? Well, they moved it offshore. That's how. And they all play this game. None of those loopholes are closed, by the way. What's called the Dutch sandwich and the double Dublin or whatever the hell it is, right? These are loopholes that the tax lawyers have named and laugh about, right? They just move the money around globally, and now they can bring it back at 8%. Well, they're going to move a lot of jobs offshore. How much are they going to bring back? And what are they going to do with it when they bring it back? Are they going to invest it in the U.S. to create jobs in the U.S.? No. I'll tell you what they're going to do with it, what they did with it before in 2005 and 2006 when they got another freebie from the Congress, very similar to this repatriation tax boondoggle. What they're going to do is use it to buy back stocks and pay out dividends, just as they did before. In fact, data studies show 2005-06, when they played this game before, brought back about $300 billion of $700 billion hoard offshore, 90% of it went into buybacks, stock buybacks, and dividend payouts, 90%. Well, you're going to see the same thing. Well, you may not see as much stock buybacks because the stock market's rising anyway, right? They do the stock buyback thing in order to drive up the value of the stock. And, the shareholders love that because they sell it at capital gains. And the CEOs love it because their compensation is based upon, in part, significantly their stock performance. So, Let's keep that stock price rising and they'll buy back stocks to keep it rising. All right, what's rising anyway? So more of that, even more of that, is going to go into dividend payouts. And more so this time, it's going to go into mergers and acquisitions. We're already seeing it happen. Plans, now that the Trump thing went through, to use the money to buy up their weaker competitors, some of whom are weak at the end of the business, of the credit cycle that we're in right now. By the way, another signal that we're nearing the end of the cycle is the weak sisters, corporate sisters, approach default. You get notable case examples of that. And we're beginning to see that already. Steinhoff in Europe, Carillion in the UK, and General Electric here in the US. They're all in trouble. Ford, they're all in trouble. It's the end of the cycle. And you see the emergence of potential defaults when this happens. It's the tip of the iceberg, you might say, of financial fragility, the defaults that begin, select ones, notable, that begin to emerge. All right, that's another reason why they're giving big tax windfalls for corporations to give them another shot in the arm to keep many of them going. Okay, so as I promised before, what's the true scope and magnitude of the business corporate investor tax cuts under Trump? Well, I've taken a shot at this in previous shows, but here's my final calculations on that. Multinational corporations are going to get the big lion's share of this. This repatriation bill, instead of paying 35, paying 8 to 10 net effective, right? In 2018, will save them $1 trillion. How much of a hoard do they have offshore? Well, officially, they talk about $2 trillion to $2.8 trillion that they should have paid 35% on, but paid zilch, because Bill Clinton, back in 97, allowed them to pay zilch on their foreign profits. And that's why they accumulated so much offshore, you see. Okay, how much? $2 trillion, $2.8 trillion? Well, that's only the Fortune 500 U.S. multinationals. There's more than 500 U.S. companies that are multinational. You know, how about the Fortune 2000 or the Russell 5000, right? They're all around the world, too, and they've been hoarding the cash and everything. I think there's at least $4 trillion in offshore hoarding going on. Okay, so if they bring that money back, if they would bring it back at 8 to 15%, average about 12-13%, instead of 35, that saves them $1 trillion. $1 trillion. You got an estimate of only 300 billion. It's really a trillion. And then for the next 9 years, it's another trillion. So that's $2 trillion. And another $2 trillion in corporate base cuts. So that's $4 trillion in corporate business tax cuts.